introduce Bob Stecker, who is going to introduce our speaker today. Thank you.
Thank you, Shelley, and welcome, everyone. First, let me mention a few items about Ed that were not included in the bio that was distributed. Ed was born and spent his early years in New Brunswick, New Jersey. After completing his undergraduate and graduate school, he started his business career at the Ford Motor Company, where he got to work with Lee Iacocca. Ed then moved on to GD Cyril, where he served as a chief financial officer, reporting to Don Rumsfeld. Some of you remember him. Went on to be the Secretary of Defense. Ed then went on to hold executive positions at ADT and Sears, where he helped lead the split up of Sears, and thereafter he joined the Allstate Corporation, where he ultimately served as chairman and CEO until his retirement in April of 2008. Once he retired, the remainder of 2008 turned out to be a bit more challenging and complicated than when he retired in April. Let me recall the situation for you. In the fall of that same year, the country's financial system was buckling under the collapse of trillions of dollars of subprime home finance mortgage paper and derivatives. The first indication of the coming collapse occurred on March 16, 2008, just before Ed's retirement from Allstate, when the equity value of Bear Stearns, whose stock had been trading at about $53 per share, all but evaporated when Bear was sold to J.P. Morgan for $2 per share. 6 months later, after the Bear collapse, Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, and Merrill Lynch, upon announcing a loss of $55.2 billion, quickly sold itself to Bank of America. The next day, the U.S. Federal Reserve announced that it had loaned $85 billion to AIG to backstop the subprime credit default swaps AIG had sold to various Wall Street banks. The week prior to this announcement regarding AIG, then Secretary of the Treasury Hank Paulson and his colleagues had begged and cajoled Ed Liddy to assume the chairman and chief executive officer position at AIG. Reluctantly, Ed accepted the position, but he stipulated that he would serve only until he had stabilized the company and that he would decline the eight-figure annual pay package proposed by the Treasury Department and instead declared that his total pay would be $1. Ed then packed his bag, said goodbye to his wife, Marcy, and flew to New York, where he spent almost 12 months reorganizing and stabilizing AIG. In large part, due to Ed's effort, AIG was brought to a position where it was able to pay back the entire $85 billion plus interest and dividends to the U.S. taxpayer, not the government, U.S. taxpayer. The Fed was able to sell the U.S. taxpayer's 79.9% equity stake in AIG for a very nice profit, and the AIG shareholders today enjoy an aggregate market capitalization of $61 billion. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome me to welcome our speaker, Ed Liddy.
Well, thank you so much, Bob, for the introduction. I've got the ubiquitous dollar right here in my hand. If for any reason I have to refer to it, it'll be handy here. You know, I want to start first by congratulating Kira and Gabby. It's we were all young once. Maybe hard to remember that, but we were all young once. And April 1 is not just April Fool's Day, but as Kira will tell you, it's also the day the envelope comes about whether you got into certain colleges or not. So I know it's an uneasy time as you try to find out, am I in what I wanted to get into, or am I waitlisted or what have you? But I congratulate both of you for accomplishing a lot and having great aspirations. I think your futures are very bright. All you have to do is seize it, and I'm confident that you will. I like the trend line of our meeting here today. So the chaplain took about 8 seconds. But it was a very high quality 8 seconds. I don't want to get in trouble with the Lord here. Gabby and Kira took about 15 seconds each. Bob, I have time for one question and then we're done. So I've got a lot to cover today, and what I want to do is save plenty of time for your questions and answers, because typically when I've done this in the past, that's where the real meat of these sessions can be found. But I'll be talking about big numbers. I will be giving you a deep dive in 3- and 4-letter acronyms. So you'll hear about ABSs and CDSs and CDOs and RMBSs and FICOs and CMBSs and a whole host. The financial services world has its own language. Before you all head to the door, let me just say I'm going to try to minimize all that stuff. And I'll try to give you major themes that permeate, I think, what happened in AIG and everything else. And that'll give us lots of times for questions. So what I'd like to do in my prepared remarks is talk about three things. What happened in 2008 and what were the causes of it? 2, what happened at AIG and what was the fix? And then 3, I'd like to give you a couple of general observations. So first, 2008. Bob set some of the stage for it. Let me just give you a little bit more complete picture. You may recall that the internet bubble burst in about the year 2000 and stock markets went down and people lost a fair amount of money. In about 2002, the country began to recover from that, and a few things happened. Number one, the equity markets began to march very, very aggressively forward. In fact, between 2002 and 2008, they went up about 70%. So we as a country felt better about ourselves. We had more wealth. At the same time, interest rates were going down. The prime rate was halved. A 10-year treasury rate was halved, largely as a result of some government actions. But all of a sudden, money was cheaper and more available, and leverage, debt, went up. And as a result of that, the country began a love affair with real estate. A love affair may be too complimentary a word. Maybe an obsession is a better word. Maybe a stalker's obsession is a better way to think about it. So we wanted real estate. We wanted to build it. We wanted to own it. We wanted to rent it. We wanted to finance it. We wanted to trade it. We wanted real estate. We wanted houses. We wanted condos. We wanted apartments. We wanted malls. We wanted commercial buildings. We wanted land. We wanted infrastructure. Anything that could pass for real estate, we wanted a slice of it. Whenever supply and demand don't meet up, crazy things happen. There was such demand for real estate and such availability of mortgage money that prices got out of hand, and we, as a country, we kind of adopted the theory that real estate values only go one way, up. And the mortgages that underlie those, that real estate value, only goes one way, up. We all know that's not true. Real estate, as you know, is a very, very illiquid asset. You can't go to Publix and buy some fish for dinner and say, well, here's some real estate. You got to use one of these. It's not only illiquid, but it's also highly levered. So of all the things you can invest in, for every dollar you invest in real estate, it can carry somewhere between $4 and $20 worth of debt. Now, if it's carrying $4 worth of debt, it's not working too hard. But if it's carrying $20 worth of debt, it's breaking its back. You know, it just can't do it. There just isn't enough equity in the system. So as a result of all that, prices skyrocketed. Everyone wants a piece of the pie. Things were great until they weren't. And in the March of about 2008, when Bear Stearns collapsed and was sold to J.P. Morgan, it was the first inkling that things had really gone awry. And thereafter, the demise accelerated. So first, real estate prices stopped going up. They didn't go up anymore. Then they started going down. And then they plummeted. And the difficulty with real estate values, you can't figure out what something is worth. You know, if there's no supply and demand, or if there's no buyers, you can't figure out what something is worth. So a house that you thought was worth X, on one day it may be worth half X the next day, because you simply couldn't figure it out. And all the debt that supported all of those all those real estate purchases, it also was called into question. I mean, can these mortgage holders, can they really pay their debt? Can they, if you have a variable mortgage that's got a teaser rate of 2% and it's going to roll over in 6%, it's going to go up to 8%, are you going to be able to afford it? So the whole system, the whole real estate ecosystem, which had become supercharged, really just collapsed. It went haywire. All of the things that normally go into conservative thinking and confidence, out the window, and therefore we were in real trouble. I would also tell you that the U.S. financial system is an incredibly powerful thing. We exported our difficulties around the world. So there were other places like Ireland and Spain and the U.K. where they had adopted some of the same demand for real estate, but they also had invested in our financial institutions, which now all of a sudden were in real trouble. So it wasn't just the U.S. system. It was the global financial system suddenly developed a severe liquidity problem. So back to my dollar. You know, a dollar is only worth what you think it is. We used to be on a gold standard, but President Nixon in August 1971, as all of you economists will remember, abandoned the gold standard. So now a dollar is worth what two people who enter into a transaction say it's worth. And it wasn't clear what a dollar was worth in the United States. It wasn't clear what a dollar was worth, and that's a liquidity crisis. So if you tried to get money out of a money market account, you couldn't do it. In fact, there was one money market fund that went belly up, and they went belly up because for every $100 you put in that money market fund, they would give you back 97. That's a recipe for disaster. So we got into a full-blown liquidity crisis, and most of the financial institutions in the U.S. and, in fact, around the world suddenly were in a world of trouble. They did not have enough capital. The capital calls that were being made on them couldn't be met. There simply wasn't enough money to go around. You know the film, It's a Wonderful Life? And at some, hopefully you'll get a chance to watch that at Christmas time. It's really an inspiring film. But at one point in time when they can't find the money, when Uncle Charlie has misplaced the funds, and there's a run on the bank, and people want their money back, and Jimmy Stewart says, well, your money's in the bank, you know, and it went from the bank, now it's in your house, or it's in your business, or it's in your automobile. You simply couldn't get at it. That is a classic full-blown liquidity crisis. Now, what were the causes of that full-blown crisis? If you Google it, there's probably in a range of 500 books that have been written on the causes of it. There's 3,000 or 4,000 scholarly articles. Everyone's got an opinion, and you all will have your own. I offer you my suggestions as to what some of the culprits or what some of the causes were. Number one, and these are not necessarily in order, but number one, I would say government policy had a lot to do with it. And what do I mean by that? Cheap money. Whenever the government intervenes in a system, it changes the equilibrium. And when money is cheap, people get greedy. They do things that abandon all reason and all caution, and that's what happened. Number two, the powers that be in Washington decided that home ownership was a good thing for the country, and it is. I firmly believe that. But home ownership in the United States has typically been 63%. It was 63.2% in the year 2000. Today, it's 63.8%. It just doesn't change very much. But the powers that be decided owning a home was a good thing, and we should drive that home ownership rate up. Well, in the end of 2008, the home ownership rate was 69%. Now, where did that other 6 or 7 points of ownership come from? Most people who wanted to buy a home already had one. Most people who could afford a home already had one. So the powers that be once again decided that if we're going to drive home ownership rates up, we've got to encourage financial institutions to lend more to what's known as subprime lenders. So everybody in this room can go out and get a mortgage, right? You can all put 20% down. You're all just fine. But a lot of people can't. They couldn't afford a mortgage, and they were in the rental market. And that was okay. That's the way people lived. But all of a sudden, oh, I, I could go buy a home. And I can do it for almost no money down. There's no documentation required. They don't even check to see if I work anymore. So all of the disciplines that go into getting a mortgage, they eroded. And as a result, more people moved into housing who couldn't afford to move into housing. And also, many of us decided we wanted a slice of the pie, and we wanted to refinance our house because it was going to go up, up, up in value, and I could pull some cash out, and I could buy a condo down in Venetian Village. And then I'd own that condo for 2 or 3 years, and I'd sell it. And then I'd buy a condo someplace else, or I'd buy a house down in Port Royal with a yacht. I mean, that's the way people thought. I can keep pulling money out, and I can keep doing better and better. You know, I believe a lot of that was due to the government's drive and the forces they put onto lending institutions to increase home ownership. I would also say government regulation, or lack thereof, completely failed. So you have OCC, the Office of the Control of the Currency. You have OTS, the Office of Thrift Supervision. And you have the regulator that regulated the Fannie and Freddie. There was no one regulator who had a view of the entire system. They all had a little piece of it, but nobody was looking consciously and aggressively and consistently at the overall picture. So institutions took on more risk than they should have, and their regulators didn't see that it was happening. I would also say, point of view, in many cases, the regulators, in some cases, they're headed by political appointments, not by people who know the business. In some cases, the people working in the regulatory firms, some of them are excellent, some of them are not, and they simply couldn't keep up with the rating agencies and the investment banks and what have you. Third, financial institutions. There was an enormous focus on compensation, and it was, I believe, misaligned. Some people call it greed. That may be an acceptable word. I think it is more a matter of misalignment. So if I get paid for short-term profits, I'm going to give you short-term profits. If I had gotten paid for long-term profits and returns, I'm going to give you those. So a complete misalignment everywhere in the financial system occurred. I would also say mortgage lenders, boy, they really lost their way. You know, it used to be when Marcy and I, 40 years ago, bought a house, we had to get 20% down. And, you know, we scraped and saved and borrowed some money from Marcy's dad, and we finally got 20% down, and we had some skin in the game. Well, those old rules got thrown out, and pretty soon you only needed 2% down, or you needed nothing down. When we got a mortgage, you could only have, you know, your household debt could only be about 27% of your total paycheck. Nobody even checked your paycheck anymore. So the all of the things that used to apply, the old school things that used to apply for mortgage brokers, went away. And pretty soon you could get some ridiculous deals to help you buy not just one piece of real estate, but a second and a third. That worked great, again, until it didn't. Appraisers, who knows? Appraisers kept looking at appraisals of property that happened last week. They didn't look at appraisals of property from 4 years ago. So the system kept ratcheting up the value. The appraisals were higher. The mortgages that you could get on the property was higher. And once again, the issue kept compounding. Technological innovation. This is a really important piece. I'm not sure that it gets enough play. But it used to be that if a bank would pay you money to have you make a deposit, it would take that money and it would lend it to someone, let's say, to buy a house. When that person bought the house, they would hold the mortgage. Well, that changed. And technology allowed financial institutions to pool all the mortgages of everybody in the room. And sometimes they would hold those mortgages because they got money for servicing them and money for originating them. But sometimes they would sell those mortgages. So they didn't quite have as much skin in the game. Instead of owning 100% of that mortgage, they would only own 80% of that mortgage. And therefore, some of the underwriting guidelines were relaxed. But the ability to take that pool and pass it down changed things a lot. Now, I'll also tell you a pool. Let me just take a minute and set the stage for you. So when this first started, think of a bucket of 100 different people whose mortgages go into a bucket. When you construct that bucket, you take 85 AAA rated people. They have really good FICO scores, right? They pay their bill on time. They don't have too much debt. They've had a steady job. There are 85 of those mortgages in my bucket. There are 10 mortgages from people who are okay, maybe they've had a little difficulty, too many credit cards, miss a credit card payment. And there were 5 who were subprime, hadn't owned a job before. Prospects for work were okay, but not great. the overarching security of that pool of mortgages derived from the fact that 85% of it was really good credit. Well, that's where it started. But that's not where it ended. So the next pool of mortgages wasn't 85, 10, and 5. The next pool of 100 mortgages was 70, AAA. It was 15, pretty good, and 15, not so good. Totally different risk profile. And they weren't just buying first homes. The 70% weren't just buying first homes. They were buying second homes. So what happened was a gradual degradation in the quality of those pools of mortgages. And those pools of mortgages got sold to you. They got sold to financial institutions in the United States and around the globe. And when the music stopped, think of a game of musical chairs, except in this game, there was one chair and 20 people going around it. And when the music stopped, there wasn't any place for people to go. Rating agencies. You know, rating agencies have a big job in the financial system. They're the ones that determine whether a financial instrument should be very secure and is AAA rated or is not so secure and is B rated. Well, when they first were set upon by people who were developing these pools, they rated, they had pretty good analytical horsepower, and they rated many of these pools of mortgages as high quality and rated them AAA. But think of the pool that I went through a minute ago. You know, 85, 10, and 5, you felt pretty good about it. When it went down to 70% really good and 15 okay and 15 not so good, they still rated it AAA. When it went down to 60, 20, 20, they still rated it AAA. Now, they rated it AAA because, well, all the mortgages aren't in Naples. Some of the mortgages are in New York, and some are in Pennsylvania, and some are in Arizona, and some are in California, and some are in Washington. So surely, the whole economy, the whole real estate world, isn't going to collapse at the same time, right? So geography gave us, the diversification of geography gave us higher ratings. You know, in my judgment, the rating agencies completely lost their way. They lost their objectivity. Remember, they made more money. The more things they rated, the more money they made. So once again, compensation comes into play. But I think that was a real issue. And then finally, I'd say, you know, U.S. buyers, you know, we all lost our way. We all wanted a piece of the pie. We wanted to, as I said, we wanted to have that condo in Venetian Village or Bay Colony or what have you. And we thought this was our time to do it. And in fact, it was. But if you got the wrong kind of mortgage or you overextended yourself, when the music stopped and there were 20 people circling that chair, you had a problem. Now, that's kind of what happened. That's my view of, and what the point I'd like you to take away from that is, it's not just one thing. It's never just one thing. It's not just, well, I blame Wall Street. It's a whole host of things. There are about 6 or 7 major players in the real estate market, and each one lost its collective wisdom and its collective conscience. And they fed on each other, and we all paid a price for it. Now, somewhere in that milieu of things was AIG. And, you know, AIG really wasn't a household word until this crisis hit. But it was well known in the investment marketplace because it was a very, very good performer. And AIG was an absolute behemoth. So what do I mean by that? I just want to bore you for a couple of minutes. AIG was the largest financial institution in the United States, top 5 in the world. It had an incredible global reach because it was started in Shanghai in 1919 by a gentleman by the name of C.D. Starr, moved it to the U.S., but his orientation was globally, long before it was popular to be global. So it had a position throughout the globe, did business in 130 countries. It had 110,000 employees, not counting all the agents who sold its products around the world. It was the largest life insurer in the world, had 90 million policies outstanding. It was the largest property casualty insurer in the world, insured 75% of the Fortune 500 companies. It was the largest lessor of airplanes in the world through its ownership of ILFC, International Lease Finance Corporation, which it bought in the early 1990s. It was one of the largest sellers of annuities in the world through its purchase of Sun America. It was the largest general finance company in the United States. It was a major, major player in swaps and derivatives and other financial instruments. At its peak, AIG had a market cap of $240 billion. That's what the company was worth. If you took all the stock outstanding, multiplied it times the price, $240 billion. It had a balance sheet that had assets of $1.2 trillion. $1.2 trillion, that's a country. In a lot of cases, that's bigger than most countries. It reported revenues of $113 billion a year, and it had net income of $14 billion a year. It was massive. Now, why did the government care about AIG? Well, insurance is a really arcane thing, right? I mean, you don't think about it very much. But believe it or not, nothing happens without insurance. So when I ran Allstate, I used to use a phrase that insurance is the oxygen of free enterprise. And that sounds really highfalutin, right? Insurance is the oxygen of free enterprise. What the heck does that mean? Well, I want you to think about it for a minute. You got up this morning, you took a shower, you got dressed, you went out and had some breakfast, you read the paper, probably online, you got in your car, you came here, we're in a nice building having a nice meal. Let's go backwards. You see the table that you're sitting at and the chairs doesn't exist. It's not there without about six different kinds of insurance that you just take for granted. You know that car ride you took to get here? Car's not built, road's not there, without about eight different kinds of insurance. You look very, very well dressed. But without four or five different kinds of insurance, you're naked. You can't get it. The clothes don't get made. They don't get shipped from China. They don't go into a retail store. There's no one to sell them at a retail store. We had a nice meal, and the service staff did a terrific job. Without insurance, not there. Product liability insurance, workers' compensation insurance, it is not there. So what the government looked at was they looked at the sheer size of AIG. They looked at its world, its role in the underlying financial system. And they looked at its connection to other really big financial institutions like Citibank and Bank of America and Wachovia and GE and just a whole host of companies. And they said, there's going to be a problem if this company fails. Now, what did AIG do that got it in trouble? Well, it's a classic insurer. It did very well, wrote classic kinds of insurance, all the things you can think of. But it also provided insurance for certain financial transactions. And before you gasp in horror, you know, insuring financial transactions is perfectly okay. So the FDIC, right, they insure your deposits at a bank. That's okay. The world of municipal bonds, a municipal bond company or a municipal entity that's not quite AAA rated can buy insurance, and it can make that bond AAA, and a lot of you have a lot of those municipal bonds in your portfolios. That's insurance. That's okay. Your brokerage accounts have level of insurance. That's okay. So insuring financial transactions, it's not the horror that when you first throw it out there, people think it is. AIG started getting aggressively involved in something called CDSs, credit default swaps. You say, what the heck is a CDS? Let me just see if I can explain it really carefully. Let's say that my good friend Bob Stucker has a lot of money. He's got taken a lot of money in the deposits, and he's made home loans, and he's decided, well, I don't want to own 100% of those home loans. I want to sell some. I come along and I say, okay, Bob, I'd like to buy some. It's got a nice interest rate. I want yield for my investors, so I'll buy some. But then I look at it and I say, well, you know, I don't know much about this. I mean, I think I'm going to get some insurance. So I go to AIG and I say, AIG, I want to buy some insurance to make sure that I'm going to get paid the interest I'm owed and the principal that I'm owed. I want to make sure it gets repaid. And AIG looks at this pool of mortgages and they say, well, it's AAA rated. It's geographically diverse. You know, it's never going to go bankrupt. And I can charge you a little bit of money and provide that insurance and I never have to worry about it. AIG was itself a AAA rated company. So it had the ability to write a lot of credit default swaps, and write a lot they did. Trillions and trillions of dollars of notional value. Remember my comment about regulators? Where was the regulation? You know, it wasn't there. Nobody saw this mushroom cloud that was appearing. I would also say that AIG did one other thing. They guaranteed, in many cases, not just that you would get the interest and principal that you bought, they also guaranteed the value. So when the value went down below certain levels, they were on the hook for that. Now, the way that works is you do something called post-collateral. You put money up. So AIG is insuring the loans that Bob Stucker sold to me. And if there's a little wrinkle, if there's a little default in them, well, AIG has to post a little collateral. If there's a bigger default, AIG has to post a bigger collateral. If there's a giant default, AIG has to post a giant collateral. And what happened, of course, is when the first chink in the armor appeared, AIG was just posting a little collateral. But by the time real estate and the loans underlying them had collapsed in value, AIG had to post a lot of collateral. And AIG was AAA rated. So when I took out my insurance policy, I said, well, I also want to make sure that if AIG ever loses its AAA rating, that they're going to keep posting more collateral. And AIG said, sure, we'll post more collateral. We'll never lose our AAA. They lost to AAA. They went from AAA, they went to AA, and then A, and then B, BBB, and then B. All the way down, they had to keep posting collateral. The net of all that is they had a $35 billion hole in the balance sheet. They had a post collateral of $35 billion and no place to go to get it. The balance sheet was already fully levered. You couldn't go borrow more money. There was no place to go. Federal government came to the rescue. AIG did one other thing. There's a practice called securities lending. It's very arcane. Nobody even knows much about it. It's a legitimate process. If I own securities and John Rowe over here, a good friend of mine from Chicago, he has a business where he needs to borrow some securities. I won't go into why, but it's a legitimate business. Well, I'll lend him the securities. Let's assume I lend him 1,000 shares of stock and it's worth $1 million. I give him the securities, the 1,000 shares. He gives me $1 million plus 2%. So I'm making a little bit of money by lending him my securities. That's pretty good, right? What could be wrong with that? The question is, what do I do with the $1 million that I got from John? Because the day is going to come when he's going to give me back my stock, and I got to give him his $1 million. Well, what most people did is they put it in really safe money market accounts, or they put it in short-term U.S. government accounts where you could make money on your $1 million. AIG did not do that. AIG went back and they loved Bob Stucker's mortgage-backed securities so much they bought some of those. When those mortgage-backed securities went down in value and John Rowe came along and said, okay, here's your stock back, give me my $1 million, I only had $600,000. Well, where does the rest of the money come from? Didn't have it. That was a $25, $30 billion hole on AIG's balance sheet. So you just add those two up, and we were $65 billion. The company was $65 billion in the hole. You know, as I reflect back on it, it was a pretty scary time. It really was. When I went to AIG in September of 2008, and the board had already agreed to this debt arrangement, which I'll talk about in just a minute, I was terrified after 2 days on the job that the company was going to go bankrupt. I mean, I was really nervous about it. And I have to tell you, there's no doubt in my mind, if the company had gone bankrupt and I was at the helm after the federal government had put in $85 billion, they would have found a way to send me to jail. You know, really, I'd have been in jail. Would it have been my fault? No, but hey, we give this guy $85 billion and he takes the company bankrupt, send him to jail. It was really terrifying. So what was the fix? The fix was very straightforward. It was four prongs. One, stabilize the company. Two, get that loan and repay every single penny that the federal government in one way, form, or shape invested in the United States. Not close. Every single penny. In the United States of America, when you owe people money, you pay it back. We're going to pay back every penny. And people at AIG understood that. Three, some parts of the company were going to be sold, but some parts were going to remain. The pieces that remained, I wanted to make sure were fit to fight. I didn't want to have a wounded animal after I'd gotten through all this, a wounded animal that 2, 3, 4 years later would put us right back in the same problem and would get gobbled up by somebody else. So I wanted to have something that was fit to fight. And four, I wanted to protect the people. And you say, well, why do you want to protect 110,000 people? They got you in trouble. No, they didn't. 10 people get you in trouble. The 110,000 people, they're just doing what they're paid to do. Protecting people in a financial services environment is critical because that's your asset. That's all you have. You don't have a building, and you do, but that's not what the business is. The business is a person. So giving people a promise for the future that they could believe in, something they could see, and they thought would, in fact, work for them, and so I'm going to be okay, so I can work on Liddy's plan, I'm going to be okay, was absolutely vitally important, and I concentrated on that. So stabilizing the company, as I said, no bankruptcy. This company is not going bankrupt, and we came pretty close. So the first government arrangement was an $85 billion loan. After 30 days, we had borrowed $60 billion of it. I mean, that's frightening. Just absolutely frightening. I wanted to preserve the value of the companies that were there. So these were big companies. The pieces of AIG, the life insurance and the property casualty and airline leasing, these were big companies that did business around the globe. If I could preserve the value by making certain that we met demands of policyholders for funds and going out and meeting with regulators and saying, you know, don't shut us down, going out and meeting with government regulators around the world and our competitors, don't shut us down. It was a never-ending process of stabilize the company and preserve the value. I needed to develop a plan, and my goal to myself and to the people who were helping me, and there were a lot of good people, 30 days. We got 30 days, people, to decide what assets are we going to keep, what assets are we going to sell. The assets that we sell, are we going to sell them in the public markets, take it public, make a public company out of it, or are we going to sell it to somebody, to the government of China, to Prudential, to Met, to a foreign insurance company? We got 30 days to decide which of those we can sell. Not sell them, but which ones can you market? Remember, in this kind of environment, you can't sell anything. You can't sell it. And these are companies that were worth, the divisions, the subsidiaries, these companies were worth $30, $40, $50 billion. No one's going to buy it when you don't know what the future holds. But I knew that I had to start the process. I had to get it done. What's the plan? Who are the likely buyers? Let's go meet with these buyers. Let's set the hook so that when things stabilize, we have a chance to sell it. Remaining parts are fit to fight. What I finally decided was, in that 30-day period of time, we were going to sell the life insurance company that was the origin of AIG. It was known as AIA. It did business primarily in Southeast Asia, and we were going to sell it via a public offering. A couple of years later, that company was taken public for $45 billion. We were going to sell the life business that did business in the rest of the world. It's a company called Alico, like the name of the road up by the airport. I think it's called Alico here. But at AIG, it was called Alico. That business was sold to MetLife. It was a great purchase. I think it was sold for $25 billion. And we just started deciding which assets we would keep. We kept the property casualty business. And today, AIG is an unbelievably powerful company in anything to do with property casualty insurance. They're a lot smaller than they used to be. A lot smaller than it used to be, because we had to sell all those assets in order to pay down the debt. So when I first went there, and I had a chance to look at the arrangement that AIG had negotiated, I use that word loosely, with the government on the loan, it was something that would have made a New York loan shark happy. It would have made him smile, because the terms were brutal. It was 8% over whatever the money was whatever the interest rate was that we had to pay, and it was 2 years. We renegotiated that, and on March 7th, we finally renegotiated the story, the package, 5 years, much more reasonable terms, and the marketplace took it for granted that now AIG was going to be okay. At the same time, Bank of America, Citibank came out with some good earnings. March 6th was the low point of the market. It lost 60% of its value. It stabilized and began to go back up. By the end of May, the market was up 30%. By the end of the year, it was up 60%. And in about May, I could see that the plan we put in place was going to be okay. So in August of that year, I went back to being retired, joining my wife. And at the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, AIG made the final payment, repaying every single penny. The government sold the money that it had, the interest that it had taken, and made a tidy profit on it. So every single penny that was invested by the federal government in any way, shape, or form was repaid with the appropriate amount of interest. It was a huge success story. A lot of people contributed to that. I'm proud I was one of them, and I'm happy that the outcome was such that I can stand here today and talk to you about it. Thank you. Where do you want to go?
Thank you, Ed. We're going to have
We're going to have questions and answers here for a few minutes, Ed, but first...
You can ask all the questions you want, Bob. I don't know about the answers, but...
Well, we'll do that, but first, what we do is want to thank you for joining us here today, and we've got a little something for you here, and it's a portfolio of mortgage-backed securities.
And I can see, Bob, it's worth 20 cents. Yeah. Not really. Thank you, Bob.
I think we just overpaid you. Anyway, thanks, Ed. Got a bunch of interesting questions here, and the audience here always produces some great questions, but particularly so today. And the one overarching question that we'll start out with is a question. It says, where do you think we would have been today had the government and U.S. taxpayers not intervened and instead let the banks that were going to fail?
You know, in my judgment, we would not be here. That would have been a catastrophic default of the financial system around the globe. Other people have other opinions, and you hear about it all the time. I think it would have been awful, Bob. You know, the financial system is about 8% of the GDP. Autos, which were also bailed out, is about 7%. Between the two of them, it's 15 million jobs. If those two institutions had been wiped out, it would have been, in my judgment, catastrophically bad.
Okay. The whole structure of our home mortgage finance system, several questions on that. You know, other countries, Germany and Canada, don't have as much government agency and taxpayer support, either explicit or implicit guarantees. Several questions here. Should Fannie and Freddie be altered in a material way? And similar questions like that were presented. You know, Bank of America announced a 3.5% mortgage program where they said we won't take any implicit, we won't go through Fannie and Freddie or FHA, we'll just take the risk on our own. What's your thoughts about can we operate a satisfactory mortgage finance system in this country without the implicit taxpayer guarantee in some form or another, or do we still need to have that?
No, I think Fannie and Freddie can be gradually, not precipitously, quickly eliminated, and we can do it all through the private sector. It's hard to get from where we are to where you'd want to be, and you'd have to really carefully think that through. But other countries do it. They don't have that kind of thing. You know, I worry a little bit, Bob, that now you start seeing, once again, our memory is short, and you begin to see low doc and no doc loans start creeping back into the system. And hopefully you all say, wait a minute, you know, we're not going to go too far with this. But I think the private sector can do a better job if the public guarantee associated with Fannie and Freddie is eliminated.
There are a number of questions as a follow-up to what you just said, which is, are we going to go back into the soup? You see how prices rising precipitously here. You see loan underwriting starting to be weaker. Are we heading back down the same trail, exposing the U.S. taxpayer again? What's your assessment of where things are going in that regard?
I don't think so. I think, you know, I worry about it. I worry about the shortness of the memory, our collective memory. But I don't think it's anywhere near where it was, Bob. And I do think there are enough, you know, with the systemically significant institutions, there's the Federal Reserve trying to provide some overarching regulation and looking at what's happening that I think puts us in a little bit better shape.
There's a number of questions here about Hank Greenberg, and let me just read them. What role did Hank Greenberg's departure from AIG as a long-term CEO play in the demise of AIG? And let me add the other ones about Hank. Was Hank Greenberg's position justified in this case that he has ongoing with the U.S. government? And a related question that someone raised is, how come the terms for the loan for AIG were so much harsher than the terms of the other assistance that money market funds and insured, uninsured bank deposits and the banks themselves on their TARP activity? So it's all related to why a special treatment for AIG, and what about Hank Greenberg?
Okay, so I would say Hank Greenberg built a fabulous company. I mean, and he built it himself brick by brick. Believe me, he built a behemoth, and I give him all the credit in the world for that. When Hank was forced out by Elliott Spitzer in 2005, about 60% of those credit default swaps that went bad were already written. So would his continued presence have made a difference? Could he have found a different solution? I'm not so sure. It doesn't seem likely to me, because people weren't going to give up those instruments. Why was the treatment of AIG so harsh? I think it was because we were the first one that the federal government decided to bail, to quote, bail out, to help. So they passed on Bear Stearns, and Bear Stearns was sold to J.P. Morgan. They passed on Lehman Brothers, and Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. So then all of a sudden they realized, oh man, Lehman Brothers may have been a bad call, because it had a more central role in the financial system than people realized. And I think when they said, okay, if we're going to bail somebody out, if we're going to help somebody, it's going to be on really, really hard terms. That was the hard terms for the first 2 or 3 months. In November, I was able to get more reasonable terms. And in March, I was able to get something that would last, so we could, in fact, work our way out of the mess that we were in.
Okay, here's one raised by one of the students. Interesting here. How does the housing market crisis in 2008 compare to the current housing situation in China? If China faces a similar burst of the real estate bubble like we did here, how might that affect the global markets?
It's a really good question, a really insightful question. And I think China has, there's a lot of empty buildings. There's a lot of condos and apartments that have been built, and there's no one living in them. But people wanted to. It was a form of speculation that was allowed. So you live in your house and you buy a second one because it's going to make money and the value is going to keep going up. It isn't going to keep going up. So I think as China tries to morph from being a planned economy to being a consumer economy, that's a difficult journey. And I think that they will have their fair share of problems with the housing market. I don't think it'll be anything like what we had, but I think they do have some severe issues coming down the road.
Several questions here about the MetLife situation. They were designated as sci-fi, and now they won at least temporarily a court ruling saying they no longer have to be subject to that governmental program. Here's a couple of questions in that regard. Will other financial firms be successful in following MetLife out of the sci-fi program? Should MetLife have been granted exclusion from the beginning from the sci-fi program? Do you have any comments on that for us?
You know, I think it should have been. I put MetLife because it is primarily an insurer. Now, it does issue variable annuities, which is a different kind of an animal, and depending upon the guarantees, can have some problems associated with it. But it's not central to the circulation of money and the global financial system the way a Goldman Sachs is, or a J.P. Morgan, or a Citibank, or those firms. So I think it was probably right for them to be excluded. And I know the government was looking at Prudential, and I'm sorry, I don't remember who else, and putting them in the same category. I'm not so sure that they belong in that category.
Okay. And one other question here, Ed, and this is an important one. Looking back on it and what you went through, if you had the decision to make again today, would you have accepted Hank Paulson's invitation?
Are you you asking me that question, or are you asking Marcy that question?
Why don't you answer for her?
You know what? I'm going to go out on a limb here as I look around this room. A lot of veterans, a lot of patriots in this room. If you had the requisite expertise and the experience, and your government came along and said, we think we're in a hell of a mess. We really need someone with your skill set. Would you please come and help us? I said yes. I'm going to hazard a guess that most of the people in this room would do the same thing. It was a steep personal price. Now, the number of times you get phone calls and people telling you they're going to kill you and they hate you, and people threatening our family and threatening Marcy. I mean, it was just, it's an unbelievable personal price. But when you look back at what was accomplished, did we save the financial system? Way too grandiose a statement. Were we one piece in preserving the financial system and the way of life that we know? I would say yes, and therefore I think I probably would do it again. Mars? She's not so sure.
Yeah. Well, Ed, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job, Ed. Thank good. You so much.
Thanks.
Nobody left.
Yeah.
Nobody
yeah.
stayed.
Yeah. It was good.
Get your book.
Yeah.